And so I thought I'd just take one little minute here at the top of the show and tell you that I hold license from the Florida State Board of Medicine as a nutrition counselor and have been in practice here in Sarasota now over 22 years. In practice totally since 19... No, there's nothing the matter with your radio. It's just been over 30 years and it's hard to imagine. But I started out with a biochemistry interest and went from there into medical botany. And medical botany is the area that looks at plants and their effects on both human and other animal bodies. And so when you talk about medical botany, the reason that I ended up in that area as opposed to nutrition was very simply that the nutrition department, at least at Northern Arizona University, where I was living then in Sedona and Flagstaff, was, well, let's just say not very cutting edge. That's about the kindest way I can think to say it. And so when I met Dr. Arthur Heavily, who ended up being my mentor there, and he turned me on to the fact that here was two groups of plants, one group of plants that were only used as medicine. And so when we think about saw palmetto and ginkgo biloba, those are things that you don't ever sit down and eat as salad. You don't have a bowl of saw palmetto berries for breakfast with some yogurt, and you don't have ginkgo biloba leaves in your salad mix. They're plants that are used exclusively as medicines. And then you have another collection of plants that are food plants, like the peach and papaya and blueberries that I had for breakfast. Those plants have medicinal properties. And those medicinal properties are part and parcel of the food. So medical botany is a wonderful arena to involve yourself in if you're interested in food and if you're interested in herbs and healing, etc. And so that became my turf at NAU. And from there, I began to study homeopathy. Homeopathy is a different way to deliver nutrients to the body. And it was because I started treating children, babies, when I was living in Sedona, and I found out that little kids wouldn't drink smelly tea. And at the time, I couldn't get them to swallow capsules, but I know how to do that now. And so I started studying homeopathy and have been a practitioner now of homeopathy for about 26 or 7 years. And at that point, I realized that I really didn't know how the body worked because I had taken this stuff in bits and pieces fundamentally to learn how to help myself. I really had no concept at that time that this was going to become my full-time work. And so as that became very obvious that it was going to become my full-time work, then I decided I needed to go back and study physiology. And actually, the laboratory I was teaching for at the time offered to pay my full ride to medical school. And I always said it took me about 30 seconds to decide that that wasn't a good thing because I had been so abused by the medical system that I couldn't comprehend being a part of it. But it really shook me into understanding that I needed to learn better how the body worked. And that's when I left my beloved Arizona and moved to Boulder, Colorado, and spent several years in the practice of a Chinese physician, an MD, who emigrated from Shanghai. She was a sixth-generation acupuncturist. And so in China, just as in the United States, acupuncture and MD licenses are separate licenses. They're not always the same, even though people sometimes perceive that everybody in China does acupuncture. That's certainly not the case. And I studied Chinese medicine with her, because there's really only two systems of medicine that exist in the world. And that's the Chinese system and the Ayurvedic system that comes to us from India. Western medicine doesn't have a system. Western medicine still looks at your body like it's a box of parts and nothing is connected to anything else. Whereas in Chinese medicine and in Ayurvedic medicine, they look at the relationships that happen between your gut and your brain, between your liver and your skin, etc., etc. So from there, I realized that I didn't want to be an alternative practitioner. In Boulder, Colorado, every other person is some sort of a clinician, it seems, or body worker or energy worker or something. And I wanted a ride with the doctors. I felt like if we were really going to change the system, we had to change the system from the inside. And as long as I was dubbed a, quote, alternative practitioner, I might not be able to run neck and neck with the docs. And that's when I got involved with the Institute for Functional Medicine. I'm a graduate of the Applied Clinical Functional Medicine training. In fact, I'm currently enrolled in a 3-year advanced clinical medicine functional training course that really stretches your brain. I got news for you. It really stretches your brain. So the nature of being an IFM practitioner, and you can always go up on functionalmedicine.org and learn more about the Institute for Functional Medicine, because I truly believe that in my lifetime it will blow the AMA in the dirt. The American Medical Association has become a handmaiden of the pharmaceutical, food, and chemical industries. And the only good news that I have about the AMA is that finally less than 20% of all doctors are members. For the first time, their membership is down to 19% this year, of which I am delighted. And it appears that for the most part, and I really mean no disrespect to the physicians that are members, but it appears for the most part that they are new graduates of school who feel like they still have to stay in the good old boys network, and there are people who do ultimately expensive procedures, and they're trying to protect the reimbursability of those procedures. And so the American Medical Association may have served us over a time, but their track record lately has not been so great. So I think that the Institute for Functional Medicine, which is a combination of physicians, MDs and DOs, acupuncturists, chiropractors, pharmacists, nutritionists, dietitians, nurses, a few veterinarians thrown in for flavor. This group encompasses people from all over the world. When I was at the last IFM symposium in San Diego in May, there were people there from 30 countries. So it's really exciting to see that the web of functional medicine practitioners all over the world is growing. And that's the term that is being embraced more, is functional medicine or integrative medicine rather than alternative medicine. Because my question to all my clients is, what's the alternative to food? Well, you know the answer. No answer. So I hope I answered, as long-winded as it was, the question of the caller last week that wanted to know who I was and what my background was and, you know, what I'm doing. And so I've got my finger in all of those pies. I'm looking at the way that food interacts with your body. I'm looking at nutrients, vitamins, minerals, enzymes, etc., that can help correct or support what is inherently challenged in the body. I'm looking at agents like herbs and homeopathic remedies that are specifically designed to support a function in the body. And I put all of those things together. A lot of herbalists don't do homeopathy. A lot of homeopaths don't do herbs. A lot of people that do vitamins and minerals and other kinds of supplements really have no training in herbal medicine or in homeopathy, even though they may use those formulas. So it's a pretty mixed bag. So I hope that answered your questions. And if you have any other questions about, you know, my ring sizes or my favorite color, or, you know, what you can get me for Christmas, then don't hesitate to give us a call at the station at 894-6469 after the show is over, and I'll answer what questions that I can. Summertime. I saw last night on the world news the winner of the hot dog eating competition, and all I could think of was, boy, would his mama be proud. The guy ate 54 hot dogs with 54 buns. Now, I don't know who these people are that decide that they want to get into competitive eating competitions, but it turns out that a Japanese man who is apparently a winner of very many competitive eating competitions, and there's all sorts of them, you know, this many pies, this many whatever, He actually got arrested outside the hot dog eating competition because he was trying to get in, and he had been banned by whatever is the organization for competitive eating. You know, this is a part of the world that I just don't know very much about. Now, I could do an entire show on hot dogs, but since you might have had one for 4th of July, I'll save that comment. But when I think about the summertime, when I think about 4th of July, the only thing I can think about is heat. And one of my team at the clinic took a vacation and went up to Boston this weekend for a holiday, you know, thinking she's going to get a nice breath of cool air. And when I saw the news yesterday, it said that it was 93 degrees in Boston, so it was actually hotter than it was here. But the first thing I think about is cooling foods. And fruits are the categories that we call cooling foods. You know, there's a concept that happens in medicine, in Chinese medicine specifically, that talks about the heating and cooling properties of food. And when we talk about heating and cooling, we're not necessarily talking about temperature. We're talking more about the way that it affects the body. So probably warming and cooling would be the more accurate term to use. But there are certain foods that naturally warm us. You know, that sitting down to that bowl of beef stew, having a bowl of chili, you know, they're deeply warming to us. I know that in Florida, when it's January and the drizzle is happening and the wind is howling and it's, you know, 43 degrees outside, there isn't anybody who gets up and goes, "Ooh, I'd love to have a piece of watermelon this morning." So traditional healing systems have already always recognized temperature as one of the major influences on our health. I mean, think about how important temperature is. Your body's 98.6 degrees. If your temperature goes up 2 degrees to 98.6, let's do that again, to 100.6. You start out at 98.6 and your temperature goes up 2 degrees, you get a fever. You're starting to sweat. You may not feel miserable, but you know you're off. If your temperature drops 2 degrees from 98.6 to 96.6, you're going to start to get the chills. Even if you're not physically shaking on the outside, you're certainly not going to be wanting to stand in the vent of the air conditioner or the fan. So our tolerance for temperature variation in our own bodies is less than 2%. So it's not particularly amazing that traditional healing systems have recognized temperature as a major influence on health. Both inner and outer temperatures are taken into account. In Chinese, for example, Chinese medicine that is, complaints like arthritis and colic and diarrhea are associated with cold, while headaches and sweating fits and circulatory troubles are associated with heat. External temperatures are seen as not only having an effect, but not just a temporary effect. In some cases, heat or cold can remain trapped inside, and that's a more complex concept. When we look at the nature of heating and cooling within the body, we want to look at meat and fried food and spices to be considered really hot foods. And what's true is that fruits are cooling foods. In Ayurvedic medicine, one of the main properties of food is called the virya, or the ability to warm or cool the body. And this effect occurs regardless of the composition of the food. So if you do a laboratory analysis of the components, they can't really tell you very much about the total effect of the system that we call food. They can't even tell you very much about the way that those foods affect people if you just do it from a laboratory. But I'll guarantee you, you ask somebody how they feel after they eat a certain food, they can report it pretty accurately. So when we look at raw fruits and raw vegetables, especially the watery things like cucumbers and summer squashes and citrus fruits and raw tomatoes and leafy vegetables, those things are all cooling to the body. And when we look at warming foods, we can look at cooked vegetables and winter squashes and tomato sauce and root vegetables and, you know, beans of all sort, from lentils to kidney beans, and nice root vegetables like sweet potatoes. Just kind of a general list, but you get the drift. And so in looking at that concept of warming and cooling foods, we can begin to make a classification that right away we get this exception. Like curry. Curry, after all, tastes hot. But surprisingly, curry is cooling. Remember, hot peppers and the like all grow in a hot climate. They initially feel hot to the taste because they expand the capillaries and they allow the blood to rush to the surface of the skin, which is why we get red-faced. The action provokes us to perspire, and when the perspiration evaporates, the effect on the body is cooling. So eat a spicy Indian meal in the middle of winter and go out for a walk, and you'll get chilled to the bone. You know, ginger is spicy too, but as a root, it's more contractive and it helps to hold heat. Hot peppers, on the other hand, are expansive and they have a tendency to disperse heat. The effects of ginger appear to be consistently warming if we talk to people who use it. You ever get cold in the wintertime, have yourself a cup of ginger tea. It's really a fast way to get warm. You take ginger and garlic and add it generously to soup or stew or something like that, and you'll get rid of the inner chill, the trapped cold that, you know, some people have had that have plagued them for years. I have clients that come into my practice, and we know that they have a hypoactive thyroid. Their thyroids are not working really well. They get cold hands and feet really easily, and if they sit still for an hour, they are in a situation where they need to go put on their socks. And those are the people that I make a cup of ginger tea for. But if we order food from the Thai restaurant at the clinic, we all sit down together every Wednesday and eat lunch as a group. And if we order from the Thai restaurant in the wintertime, I always say double garlic, double ginger, because I want that warming effect. So when we look at a food, it isn't just, oh, a hot pepper is going to make us hot. It doesn't work quite that way. The nature of the cooking techniques can also change the food. And so when we bake and dry roast and fry and saute, we have a tendency to take food and make it more warming. Well, let's save that for another show. So when we look at this heating and cooling food concept, then in the summertime, which is very hot, we would, of course, want things that are cooling. And equally, in the wintertime, which is cold, we would want more foods that are hot or warming. So if we begin to look at this concept of heating and cooling foods, we can actually make ourselves more comfortable. Well, there are probably individuals that went out to their 4th of July event yesterday with their hot dogs and their hamburgers and their potato salad and actually made themselves a picnic, while quite traditional, was actually going to make them hotter. And yesterday, which was like being out in a bowl of hot soup, because it wasn't just hot, it was so blinking humid until we got to about 4:30 or 5 o'clock, they actually would have been more miserable. Where if they had eaten a meal that had more cooling foods, more raw green salads, cucumber salad, fruit salads, etc., they would have likely have been able to maintain their body temperature in a different way. You know, when you think about fruit is really the final stage of the unfolding of a plant. The plant reaches its fullest self-development. It attains its ultimate goal. You know, we don't happen to think of a plant having a goal, but certainly, just as we are driven to reproduce, so are the plants. And so the ultimate goal is to make the fruit that has the seed that's going to fall off the tree and rot and become the beginning of the next generation. You know, the rest is up to the birds and the bees and the wind and the rain. And fruit is such that you buy it, you know, firm. The peach that I had this morning, you know, 2 days ago was firm, and then it ripened, 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 and then it's ripe. And then as soon as it's ripe, it rots. So very quickly after maturing, the fruit decays, because that's the only way that the seed can sprout into new life. So this expansive, cooling, relaxing, and alkalizing effect. You know, if I have one more person that comes in the clinic that talks to me about pH, I'm going to have to start doing pH classes, because there are so many properties that are being assigned to alkaline and acidic that are such bad science today. Let's see if we can set part of it straight. First off, we do need foods, more foods that are alkalizing in the body, and fruits and vegetables in general are alkalizing, whereas meat and grain are in general acidifying. And we have too much acidy foods in our diet. And again, just like with heating and cooling, it's not the property of the food that you can measure externally. You might measure an orange and say it's acid, but internally it's alkaline. Hope that didn't confuse you more. But if we look at fruit, they're all alkalizing with the exception of plums and prunes, which of course are dried plums, and cranberries. Those things are all acid forming. So fruits are thought in Chinese medicine to support openness and lightness and cheerfulness and expansive behavior. Now, when people eat too much fruit, and I do see somebody in my practice at least once a month that just eats too much fruit. They just think it's so delicious, and it is. You know, I mean, think of this perfect package. You know, we got this portable sealed unit that's juicy and delicious and easy to transport and colorful and full of nutrients. I mean, the food industry wishes they could do something like that. Well, if we eat too much fruit, we become overexpansive. And, you know, the word I think of for that is spaced out. We move too far away from the contracted center. We lose our concentration. We lose our focus. So when you talk to people that are dingbats, that are fruitarians, well, now you can understand why. So if you take somebody who's stiff and rigid and Ichabod Crane-like, and you add more fruit to their diet, they do become more cheerful and more expansive in their behavior and more open and light. But if you take somebody who's already pretty light and you give them too much fruit, they become a dingbat. When we look at the other things that are excessively expansive, sugar, alcohol, and drugs, we'll understand that relationship more clearly. So too much fruit or too much fruit juice can really weaken the intestines. In fact, one of the things that I look for is fluffy, frizzy hair split at the ends that often shows me that this is going on. And this happens, I see it oftentimes with children, that the parent gives them fruit juice and the kid doesn't want to eat anymore because they're getting so much sugar and they're getting such a good buzz off the fruit juice that they don't want to take in calories from food. Fruit is best digested at room temperature. When you take a peach off the counter and eat it, it's going to actually digest faster than a peach that came out of the refrigerator because your body has to heat it up. So, but the other side of that is that it has the ability to cool the body. So in sweltering summer heat, taking that fruit salad out of the refrigerator is a really good idea because fruit is so cooling to begin with that when we chill it further, we're going to get more of a cooling effect. There was an interesting study that I read last week. I'm sorry I can't cite the journal that it was in, but it was talking about runners and whether they gave runners something that was a slurpy kind of product. I'm not referencing that brand name, but you know, a slushy smoothie kind of icy drink versus just drinking water while they were doing their run. And it turned out that the people that took the slushy drink lasted some number of minutes longer than the other people did. I guess that isn't a very good citation of a study, but you get the drift. So if we want to have a diet that is really suited, well, I would say for the pursuit of inner peace, I mean, I think all of us just want to be happy. All of us want to be comfortable. All of us want to be easy in our body. Then we want to look at making sure that we get that pint of fruit into our bodies every day because it does support artistic expression. It does support this quietness, this coolness, kind of poetic, isn't it? So when I think about the summer, the very first thing I think about is mangoes. And I think about Pine Island mangoes. Because, you know, you just drive south of here, over there by Fort Myers, and then head out to where you're going to get wet, and you're going to be at Pine Island. And they have taken mangoes to the absolute maximum of fabulousness. In fact, it was totally amazing to me when I took a class at the Fruit and Nut Society, which is a wonderful organization here in Sarasota that obviously is all about people who are interested in fruits and nuts. And they had a guy that came up from Miami, where the University of Florida has their mango experimentation farm. And, you know, I called him Dr. Mango. And he did a really wonderful class. And I was totally amazed to find out that they had 40 different species of mangoes growing in this particular garden. Stunning. And it went everything from giant trees that were 30 feet tall, mangoes that weighed a half a pound, to mangoes that weigh 7 pounds. In fact, there's one of the mangoes that they have down in Pine Island that they call a condo mango, and they call it that because it's conducive to container gardening, and they're naturally small by nature, and they can be kept small by selective pruning, so they can work in things like suburban backyards. You just cut the tips of the branches once or twice a year, and you can keep the tree about 6 feet tall. So of these 40 species of mango, you're going to find out that mangoes started getting appreciated probably somewhere around 6,000 years ago in India. And they're so integral to the Indian culture that mango leaves and their flowers are used in Indian religious ceremonies, such as marriage. So mangoes are cultivated all over the Caribbean area, the West Indies, California, Florida, Mexico, Hawaii, Brazil. They're in the same botanical family as pistachios and cashews and even mahogany. So in Palm Island, I found 40 species, but there are about 1,000 in the world. The ones that we get the most is the Tommy Atkins. That's a fibrous mango, but it's very colorful, it's very good keeping, and it's related to the larger Hayden mango that was developed in South Florida more than 50 years ago. And so the Alfonso currently is considered to be the king of the mangoes because it's got this velvety flesh and this really strong aroma that, you know, sometimes you can smell almonds and sometimes you can smell coconut and sometimes you can smell vanilla all together. But mangoes are really high in vitamin C and they're very high in beta carotene. And when we put those two things together, we get magic. And we also get magic because they're really high in fiber. And so right away, I'm going to tell you my very, very, very favorite thing to do with a mango, which is to cut it, peel it, put it into cubes, stick it in a zip-top bag, and stick it in the freezer. Now, if you happen to have a juicer, and if not a juicer, at least a food processor, and you take that frozen mango out and you put it through the juicer, you're going to get something that comes out of the juicer that's like soft serve ice cream. Only it's going to be 100% mango. And then I will expect the next day I will see a dozen roses on my desk that you will have sent me because it will be the single best thing you ever put in your mouth. So when we look at mangoes, we're looking at a food that's got such history, not only history about just how darn good it is, but history about its qualities that actually change consciousness. You know, the Buddha said there is no heaven without mangoes. And so when we look at heavenly mangoes, we can begin to look at the constituents that are in there, and they're way more than just simply beta carotene and vitamin C. Beta carotene, you know, becomes vitamin A in the body. It's not vitamin A, it's actually pro-vitamin A. When we look at preformed vitamin A, we have to look at it coming out of an animal. But beta carotene, which is one step away from vitamin A, is something that we need that, you know, has been demonstrated that it reduces cancers across the board. I read a fabulous study last week when I was in Chicago about women who have the genetic predisposition for Alzheimer's disease. If they have the highest quartile of beta-carotene in their blood, again, quartiles, if you're measuring a particular constituent in the blood, let's say the number is from 20 to 100, then 20 to 40 would be the first quartile, and 40 to 60, 60 to 80, 80 to 100, each of those would be quartiles. So the women that had the highest quartile, the ones between 80 and 100, they reduce the risk of actually manifesting Alzheimer's by greater than 75%. So we've seen that high beta carotene protects against oral and esophageal cancer, stomach cancer, colon and rectal cancer, bladder cancer, breast cancer, cervical cancer, oral cancer, lung cancer. It just goes on and on. And we're going to get big bunches of beta carotene in the mango. I mean, look at the color. The color is bright orange, gold. I've seen a few yellow ones, but more often they're the orangey gold colors. And this is giving us that delivery of beta-carotene. And remember, beta-carotene will only turn into vitamin A if you have a vitamin A deficiency. If you don't have a vitamin A deficiency, beta-carotene stays beta-carotene, which is an antioxidant. And that may be why it's so cancer-protective. But mangoes are also high in water-soluble vitamin C. You know, and you got to have that to support collagen. That's what binds together the cells of the connective tissue. I had a client in the office a couple of weeks ago, and her face was so incredibly aged for her age. Her visible age versus her driver's license age there was a big spread. So collagen holds your face up. I mean, literally. Well, it not only holds your face up, it holds your bladder up. It holds all your parts together. So when you look at somebody and they're saggy and baggy, then they're individuals that are usually protein deficient, but they're also vitamin C deficient. But remember, vitamin C prevents viruses from penetrating into the cell membrane. Viruses can only reproduce within the cell. Remember, viruses can't live all by themselves. They're kind of freeloaders. They got to puncture into a cell in order to be able to replicate themselves. Well, if you have high amounts of vitamin C, you can't let a virus get in the cell. Vitamin C is necessary to absorb iron in order to make good blood. Since the walls of small blood vessels are made up of connective tissue, bleeding is one of the most common signs of vitamin C deficiency. And so we don't have to have scurvy, a disease that results from a lack of vitamin C, you know, characterized by bleeding gums and loss of teeth that are caused by weakened bones. We can be somebody who bruises easily. So when we look at deactivating carcinogens, vitamin C works in that area. So when we look at this combination of fiber and vitamin C and beta carotene, mango becomes a real winner, but it becomes a special winner when we think about some of the polyphenols or some of these other compounds that are present in the mango. And the one that I would put the most notation on is something called anacardic acid. Anacardic acid is a very unusual compound. It's found in very few plants, not even food plants, but just plants anywhere in the world. And again, in the country of India, they've done a lot of studies on this because there's been so much information that have come from the Vedic text, come from the ancient Hindu texts about mango being this particularly sublime food. And so there are actually groups of individuals that will fast on mangoes for days and days and days and go into a meditative state. Well, anacardic acid, it turns out, is a sedative stimulant. And you might be rubbing your ear right now and wondering if I just made a mistake in language when I said sedative stimulant in the same sentence, but it actually makes you calm and yet alert. Most sedatives make you logy, and most stimulants, you know, wire you up. But here you've got a chemical compound that occurs in nature that both makes you alert and allows you to be calm. So drug companies are studying anacardic acid because that would be a really, really cool drug for them to be able to patent. Well, forget about all of that. Forget about beta-carotene and vitamin A and vitamin C and fiber and anacardic acid and Oh, and by the way, mango powder, amchur, which you can find, you know, in virtually any good spice rack, that comes from green mangoes. It's one of the things that adds sort of an acid bite to a lot of chutneys and curries and things like that. It actually has those protein digesting enzymes that I talk about so much on No Nonsense Nutrition. But if you forget about all of that, they're just delicious. And so when we look at bringing mango into the diet, think about the way that they do it in India with lassi. Lassi is a popular and traditional Indian yogurt-based drink. You blend yogurt with some extra water or milk and some Indian spices, often cumin. Ground roasted cumin is the most common in India. Occasionally a sweet lassi is made, and then you're going to put some sugar in it instead of some spices. But, or just sweeten the yogurt with honey. That's a common thing that's used to make lassi. But this is a chilled drink. And it's used in the hot weather. It's mostly taken with lunch. And sometimes they put the spice turmeric in it when especially we're looking at treating any kind of digestive issue. Actually, I had a surprise last week when I went to one of the local health food stores, and I actually found fresh turmeric being sold. They look about, probably the size of your thumb, and they kind of look like little grubs. But turmeric is in the same family as ginger, and it has these incredibly marvelous properties of reducing inflammation. And so in India, they put turmeric powder into the combination of yogurt and mango together in order to treat any kind of gastroenteritis. So when we look at sweet lassi, and in fact, my aunt and uncle lived in Sri Lanka. It was called Ceylon in those days, and they turned me on to a lassi that used to be made with rose water. And so they'd take rose water and yogurt that was sweetened with honey and put saffron in it. And if that just sounds dreamy, you got the dreamy, creamy milkshake of the world. It might make you a little drowsy, and so sometimes that's used at night for people that have sleep disorders. There was even mint salted lassi that was a favorite of my Uncle Charles. And so it's most commonly found in Indian restaurants overseas. There's only a couple of places here in Sarasota that I've actually found lassi, but I'm a fan of mangoes in July, when they are as perfect as they possibly can be. Then you can cut them up and eat them later into the summer by keeping them in the freezer. But the nature of taking mango, just cutting it up and eating it as the fresh fruit. You know, if you want to remove mangrove flesh from its large flat seed, just take a knife blade around the side of the seed to cut the mango in half, and then cut the seed away from the flesh. And then cut the flesh into a crosshatch pattern, and then push on the skin and you turn the mango inside out, and then it's really easy to cut the cubes of the flesh off. If the mangoes are going to be pureed, then you can just peel them and seed them like you would bell peppers. Some people roast or grill them until the skin becomes black all over, and then they throw them into a paper bag until they're cool enough to handle, and then the skin will just peel right off and the soft flesh can be squeezed away from the seed. Lots of different ways that we can take that delicious mango, but you know, you ever get a chance to go down to Pine Island, check out the amazing mango varieties that grow, because they, or down to Homestead, to the mango experimentation farm, because these selections that come from around the world are really creating a huge big cash crop here. You know, as global weirding continues to take place, and it's really global heating, it's no longer global warming, plant species are moving north. We have some trees in the United States that have already moved north almost 200 miles. They're growing in places that they never grew before. And conversely, things that used to grow somewhere aren't going to be able to grow anymore. And so it appears that Florida is losing a good bit of its citrus and is going to be gaining a good bit of mango. And so one of the reasons that the mango experimentation farm down in Homestead is existing is because they want to find the crops that are going to do the best in this climatic environment. And they trim all their mangoes so that they stay in manageable shape. The only thing that's problematic about letting your mango get 20 feet tall is that when the ripe fruit falls, it splashes on your driveway and not very usable. So you can top off your mango every year at about, you know, 10 feet or so that you can make it manageable. Actually, last year, the mango tree I have planted in my yard, we had a lot of trouble year before last with the squirrels getting all the mangoes. You know, their mamas didn't raise no fools. They know what a fresh mango tastes like, and they'll take that mango off and they'll chew about a third of it and then leave the rest of it, just enough to make me ornery. And so I learned from a buddy of mine that's an old Florida farmer that if you took a zip top bag, one of those gallon sized zip top bags, and cut a hole in one corner of it and then put the zip top bag over the mango so that the hole at the bottom will allow rain to fall out of the hole in the bottom so that we don't end up waterlogging the mango, then the squirrels can't get to it. And it was a very effective technique. The tree looked a little funny with zip top bags hanging all over it, but it saved the mangoes. Because the first year that I had the squirrels take all the mangoes, I called a buddy of mine who's a old Florida farmer, and I said, what do I do about it? And there was this long pause on the phone when Michael was thinking, and he came back to me, and he said, well, I got a recipe for squirrel and mango stew. So rather than having a recipe for squirrel and mango stew, the best thing to do is to protect those mangoes. And so that tree can be, again, topped off to make it manageable, because you're going to get a whole bunch of mangoes all at one time, or within a pretty short period of time. Within about 2 weeks, they're all going to, you know, harvest. And so if you're a mango aficionado big time, I met a doctor when I was teaching in Houston last year that has 9 different mango trees in his yard, and he said that he planted the Floragon, which was a Florida species, because they came in late May. And then he planted the Malika because that one came in July, and then he planted the Golden Nugget because that one came in August and September. So you can actually have different species of mango growing in your yard, each of which comes in to harvest at a different time, and as a result, you can have months and months of mangoes available to you. So if you take this ripe, sweet mango, about 14% sugar, maybe 12, maybe 15, little tiny bit of acid. And did I mention that there's a little bit of vitamin D in there? Yeah, it's kind of a surprise because we don't get vitamin D from the plant kingdom very often, but there actually is vitamin D in mangoes. And then we get these magic little enzymes that improve digestion and intestinal health. And we get a little bit of sulfur compounds in there. You know, I'm a big sulfur hustler here on No Nonsense Nutrition. We don't always have to get sulfur from broccoli and asparagus and eggs and onions. We actually get a little teeny tiny bit from our mangoes. But put that together with the beta carotene and the other carotenoid pigments, and what you end up with is an incredibly delicious piece of fruit. Most of the time when mangoes are harvested in the United States, they're dipped into boiling water just for a minute to make sure that any critters that are on them are killed. The local harvests, rarely that's the case. But, you know, in 2006, the United States Department of Agriculture ruled that you could irradiate them to sterilize insects like the mango seed weevil. And we do have a radiation facility for treating food that is just north of Tampa in Mulberry, Florida. And I'm happy to say that their business is failing, that the irradiation of these particular foods has not been proven to be financially successful. And so we're not seeing much in the way of irradiated mangoes out there, which I am quite delighted about, because I do not think that Mother Nature intended for us to expose foods to this kind of irradiation. But, you know, I always want to put out that warning that there are people who do have a skin irritation that can come from a mango, just like they can from a cashew tree or a pistachio. There is a skin irritating oil that can be found in, you know, poison ivy, poison oak, poison sumac, cashew shells. But this itchy rash can come fundamentally from the skin, and it's always a surprise to me that somebody could react to the skin, but they don't react to the fruit at all. So if you're somebody that you've ever handled a mango and it's made your skin irritated, don't believe for a minute that you're allergic to the mango. You're reacting to the urushiol, which is this toxic compound that exists on the skin. And remember, it's what the plant has used as its own bug spray to keep the critters off so you can enjoy it. So keep cool this summer, and keep cool with a mango and maybe a glass of lassi, and something I think you'll enjoy.